Thank you all. Now Kyle has been an instigator and a kind of schemer and dreamer on this engagement of the Metal Lab and the Arnold Arboretum from the very start. Kyle is a PhD student here at Harvard in the program in Visual and Environmental Studies. His interests include the intersection of ecology, education, cognition, and new media and technology. And so it's a terrifically kind of fitting project for Kyle to lend his energies to. Before Kyle begins, though, we've checked with Ned, who introduced himself a moment ago as the director of the Arnold Arboretum, and I wonder, Ned, if you could just give us a moment's description of what the Arnold Arboretum is and its role in the university and the community.
Okay, sure. So for how many have been to the Arnold Arboretum? That's a good start. Okay, and the rest of you will get there soon. And so it's one of the most beautiful parts of Harvard University. It's a huge piece of property in the Plain, Roslindale, West Roxbury neighborhoods. It contains the oldest public arboretum in North America and 15,000 curated organisms, about 70 people who work there to take care of these organisms, from IT to education, public outreach. Basically, from the day you're born to the day you die, we're trying to actually interface with the city of Boston and our neighbors. We have a lot of research going on, but one of the great things about our collections is that they're free and open to everybody every day of the year. The city of Boston actually owns the land that we sit on. Harvard donated it to the city of Boston as part of the Emerald Necklace that was designed by Olmsted in the last part of the two centuries ago. And so we have a unique opportunity to sort of take what's in a university and in one of the outstanding living collections of plants in the world and think about the relationship between what we have and what we know and how we can interact with society at large. And really, it's been an amazing set of interactions with Meta Labs. I've only been here under 2 years, but we ended up bumping into each other early. And what we're trying to rethink is the 350-year history of how living collections give pieces of paper or put signs in front of people with a very small bandwidth of information about what are incredibly interesting groups of biodiversity. So I'll stop there, but I think it's been a wonderful relationship.
Thanks, Ned. So Kyle's going to talk about that relationship and the ways in which we're beginning to explore this kind of opportunity that Ned just described of rethinking the ways in which these disparate locations of the university, the arboretum, and the community can be brought together by technology, the ways in which we can sort of reboot our experience of perceiving the environment, understanding the relationship between among the plants that are curated in the collection with the ecology of not only plant diversity in global context, but in the urban context quite specifically. I'll just give you a caveat that what Kyle's going to describe doesn't sound like a technology project at first, at least. But I think it doesn't sound like a technology project in a really rich and fruitful way, fruitful, so to speak. Kyle has indicated that he's happy to take questions throughout, and I'm involved with the project as well, so I may jump in with questions and answers to questions as well. But I will hand it over to Kyle.
Thank you very much. It's really an honor to be here to talk at the Berkman Center, and especially with such a fascinating mix of people in the room. I'm really excited for your questions, your thoughts, and I really appreciate, Ned, you introducing the Arboretum in such a vivid fashion. It really is a delightful space that has so many different affordances all mixed in one, and really reflects the diversity of people who come through there and the diversity of the staff who make it happen. So, as Matthew kind of indicated, our project is at a kind of pivot point. We've been doing a lot of thinking and reflecting over the last several months about what kinds of projects might be interesting when you bring together a digital media group with a place like the Arboretum. And because of this kind of pivot point we find ourselves at, I thought for this talk I might lay the attention less on exactly what technology we want to build or the ins and outs of it, and more on the kind of conceptual background we're dealing with, and more about the place, and kind of looking at ways you can cut across find themes that cut across the landscape and how one might respond to them, and kind of to then introduce, through analyzing the landscape and analyzing concepts and introducing ideas connected with physical landscape network technologies, share some hypotheses about what we're up to. And my kind of ultimate goal is to sort of turn it over to the room to see, you know, what have we missed, you know, and what might we consider, and overall, like, what would be powerful interventions? I find that we're preoccupied by questions of how expression and education and engagement can all come together, how science and art can come together, how can you augment a space without including a space, and how do you make ideas and data accessible that otherwise you would just never find, and how do you make all these affordances live together all in one? It's a problem of even having too much. So we've already heard a lot about what MetaLab does and about the Arboretum. Thank you, Ned. I thought I would go through a bit about the kind of different layers of the landscape. So one thing that's there is just plain beauty, right? And people moving through the landscape and finding it restorative. You have people walking their dogs, you have evening and weekend strolls, you have visitors from around the world delighted to see the blooming lilacs. What tree is this, Ned? Cherry tree. So,
unless we have a tag number, I can't see from this distance.
So even just with this, with the fact that people are coming through here and appreciating it at this purely aesthetic level, you can already begin to see ways that people might respond technologically and already do, which is by taking photographs. So how might one sort of seize that and create a kind of map of all of the different parts of the Arboretum that are photographed, which are photographed more than others? Could you even kind of hack the landscape a little bit and take what is a very structured path that most people take and relay it and create a kind of virtual map online so that you take the beauty of the landscape as a chance to kind of remap? The plants are labeled. Here we have two children who will feature a lot in this talk, taking a look to find out what plant this is. So as you move through the landscape, every single plant has its name and it has a bit of metadata attached to it. So we can ask, how much more data might somebody want to see about that plant? And what kind of cycle might there be between learning information about that plant and having a sensory experience of it and exploring it? Is there, as I've asked some people who I've talked with at the Arboretum, is there too much? Do you want to have a completely kind of unmediated experience of moving through the landscape and just let the tag be the only amount of information? Or would you have an iPad in front of you giving you layer after layer after layer of information about that plant's history? And then it's a thoroughly artificial landscape in many ways. Here we see an arborist cutting off a limb. How could the labor of these arborists and horticulturists be made visible? How can the labor that goes into creating such a beautiful landscape be made turned into an opportunity to share knowledge, to share spots in the Arboretum that have a distinct sound or that have a distinct view, or where you could put a camera on top of an arborist's head and get up inside the canopy and see the Arboretum in a way that you've never imagined possible. And then there's Ned doing research where they swab down an entire ginkgo tree in order to create, I think, the first microbiome. So all this is taking place in the same place, these restorative experiences. Someone's walking by and having a moment of reverie as somebody else chops down a branch to ensure that plant isn't a danger, while research is taking place, while a curator walks by and is questioning whether a certain plant needs another next to it in order to more fully represent that family, etc.
John, can I ask, does the Arboretum have a mission?
Does the Arboretum have a mission?
Yeah. It does. It's the mission. It has actually several missions. So it's part of Harvard. Its core missions are shared with everything else in terms of education of undergraduates, graduate students, as a site for study. It's also got a worldwide mission in conservation biology, germplasm, and now we're getting very heavily into urban ecology. And as a public mission, because we worked with the city of Boston and actually have a formal 1,000-year relationship with the city of Boston, we are very much part of Harvard's outward-looking face to the citizens that surround us. So we actually have this amalgamation of different missions, and part of what we're working on right now from the public, we're in public schools, for example, with many of our programs, is to have more of the university and the public flowing back and forth in terms of information. But the mission is ultimately, if you go back to the original mission statement, is to simply grow every possible woody plant that you can grow in the city of Boston. Now, that's not really a mission so much as a sort of a set of things you do, but it doesn't speak to what you can do with those trees.
So, particularly with science, I find myself asking, how can we bring open data and open science out into the public, but have this be something that you experience within a landscape? What would it mean to learn about a lecture on the evolutionary history of a ginkgo tree when you're in its very presence? Does that make a difference? How should that take place? Should it be purely through sound, or should one have a kind of augmented experience of it, or should one hold an iPad and trace through its evolutionary history? And additionally, how do you manage and communicate between the scientific form of knowledge, a kind of digital media form of knowledge, and an attention to what the public can possibly understand? I think something that I find that very challenging but very exciting with this project is the level of communication and sort of innovative communication it requires to sort of translate between different languages and then eventually imagine how you can design that into platforms that are then accessible to public and easily understood. I don't think there are many cases in which such technologies are being created, and it's a very compelling challenge. And so just as the last layer, I would say, is that the Arboretum isn't just its living collection, but it's the data about the living collection, about the time that that tree was set on fire accidentally, or the time that that tree was hit by a stolen car, or the time that that tree had work done on it. There are massive databases about the growth of the plants and how they've changed through time. And what you see on the left is a specimen from the herbarium. And actually, the Arboretum keeps a kind of library of its dried specimens from its landscape over the course of its history, and that these can be used to track genetic evidence about these plants, but also can be kind of keystones to climate at that time. And not very far from here, there's an attached herbarium with over 5 million specimens. And again, these are kind of a library of the world's flora. So how can we make these things that just sit there and are used in research but are never passed through the eyes of most public, how can we bring those out to people? And the sort of bottom part there, you see someone out on a collecting mission. I think in communist China, being watched over carefully, bringing a specimen back to the herbarium. How can we take these sort of notes that that explorers have taken for over 100 years and bring them out to the public? And what kinds of knowledge about science what kinds of knowledge about the history of science would that make available? And it kind of is the last element I'll throw in here, is that the Arboretum has this extra fantastic and fascinating variable, which is called Bussy Brook Meadow, which is this long-neglected urban wild that has been a combination of Arboretum land, city land, and MBTA land, that in the last 2 years, the Arboretum has officially decided to turn into an experiment, right? And so there's this Blackwell footpath that people are able to come through from the Arboretum to Forest Hill Station. But as they pass through there, they're surrounded by what most people would call weeds, but which, to the scientists researching this collection, is a fantastic opportunity to explore the spontaneous vegetation of that landscape. And I'll talk a little bit later about ideas that we have, a project that we're developing to do an art installation with the artist Terry Reap there. I thought I would take this first opportunity to kind of begin to get into the modes of thinking that we are concerned with, where we can learn to see differently and how one might do that. So this part of Bussy Brook Meadow fascinates me in that it's readable. So Matthew and I were walking through there with the great research scientist at the Arnold Arboretum, Peter Deltregi, who wrote a book called Wild Urban Plants of the Northeast. And he is on a political mission to have people rethink what they call a weed, to have them realize that that's a value judgment, and to instead understand weeds as spontaneous vegetation. And that is, it is simply a matter of context what we call a weed. So if you look at something like this, to most eyes, those are weeds, right? But if you learn a bit more, you suddenly can understand that these reeds have names, and that they're divided, and that they're divided in a way that is readable, and that they actually are what he would call a cosmopolitan collection of plants, that they're from Australia, North Africa, and Europe, and that they've come together in a way, and they've kind of figured out a way to work together. And then, in fact, they're pulling up what pollution lies within this landscape and holding it there in ways so that it doesn't make its way into the networks of effluent in the sea. And you can learn about exactly what their functions are. So what was originally just a sort of blank landscape becomes, to someone who passes by, a site where networks and natures are coalescing in powerful ways, and where the history of the world is coming together, and histories that will really matter to our future, in the sense that, as Peter Deltregi describes, these are the plants of the future if our climate continues to change in the way it does. These are the plants that have the ability to survive. So our question is, how do I make this available, or how do we make this available to people using mobile technologies rather than me having to sit and walk through a slideshow? So as I switch into kind of this next more conceptual portion of my talk, and moving out of looking at the layers of the Arboretum, I wanted to sort of think more hypothetically about the challenges and opportunities that we face. And what we see here really has nothing to do, or should have nothing to do, with the Arboretum, but I'm forcing it to. It's a cognitive scientist understanding of perception from 1976, Ulrich Nesser, from Cognition and Reality. And what I think is so wonderful about it is it gives us a kind of vision of what it is to move through a landscape. And to do so in a cyclical fashion. And it helps us to begin to think about how media might play a role. So one moves from perceptual exploration and sort of sampling the environment, moving towards a plant, to kind of taking up that information and then having it modify their schema. So as it was with the image of Bussybrook Meadow, we kind of sample the weeds, and then we pull that information, and it has us modify how we're mapping that place and where we place it within, you know, are those plants simply local, or are they actually a part of a kind of global network? And then this redirects our perceptual exploration, and we move to another spot within perhaps Bussybrook Meadow or anywhere. And my fascination is with the way that these kind of cycles might have media brought into them, so that your perceptual exploration might be a turning from information on a device to the world and back again. So as Ned was indicating, the Arboretum is so multifaceted, and this is something that we are kind of confronting in the technologies that we're imagining building there. And this is an original map that by Frederick Law Olmsted, describing the Arboretum, or giving a vision of what he thought the Arboretum should be. Because it could very well have just been a closed-off set of trees that were used for study. But he and Charles Sprague Sargent, the founder of the Arboretum, were certain that what they wanted at the time was to have something that the public could explore, that could be a kind of spur to public appreciation of plants, that could be facilitate multiple missions at once. And Charles Sprague Sargent was insistent that the roads, that Boston build roads so that visitors to the Arboretum could have a kind of almost filmic experience of the landscape, so that they would move on their carriages through the landscape, and as he said, a visitor driving through the Arboretum would obtain a general idea of the arborescent vegetation of the North Temperate Zone without even leaving his carriage. So these are sort of truths of the landscape that are there, and that we are that we respond to differently now because we walk, or because we see nature differently. And we don't see And the this is a different layer that I'm meant to talk about. What also distinguishes the Arboretum is that it's not like your typical botanical garden, like this one in Paris. It's not obviously classificatory in its layout. Instead, it's sort of naturalistic. It seems like a forest that you're moving through. And this is something that was important to Olmsted when he made his design. He actually didn't want to do the Arboretum at first. He said that it was a park and an arboretum seemed to be so far unlike in purpose that I do not feel I could combine them satisfactorily. So he had this challenge of how to kind of create the naturalistic landscape that he found valuable and to make possible the sort of research and kind of horticultural knowledge dissemination that was important for the function and the mission of the Arboretum. So as a scholar of Olmsted describes it, when one moves through the Arboretum, one moves from the kind of unconscious experience of Olmsted's designist scenery to conscious concentration on individual elements. So there, as I was kind of trying to indicate with that perceptual cycle, there's this movement built into the landscape there where one is invited into a reverie of a kind of constantly unfolding landscape that seems naturalistic, and yet then you might see a kind of shiny label calling to you, and you might go and inspect that plant and then learn more about it and have a more conscious experience, and then again start walking and move back. And so there's this sort of way in which there's a grain to the landscape where it's asking you to move in certain ways. And for us, this is something that we really want to be cognizant of. And I think one of the main technologies, and I'll finally get specific about something that we've planned on, that we intend to try to make, we want these technologies to kind of follow that grain, but also reroute it. And so one thing that we're really excited about is a kind of notion of a field notebook or a digital field notebook that would be useful for children, for adults, and for anyone who would move through the space. How could you use a device to kind of track the ways that your perception of the place are changing? And how could you take notes on what you're seeing? And if you find a mushroom, take note of it and ask and make sure that later you'll go look that up. Or how can a child write down their observations of what animals they've found? And then to have this build up over time, and so that you could have the kind of reverie and reflection that the landscape invites you to partake in, take place later afterwards in reflection, so that you can reflect on what the landscape means to you, and you can build your perception over time and kind of lay your own layers upon the landscape. And this is a kind of sense of the kind of perceptual switching that takes place. But one thing that's very different about the Arboretum from the kind of past vision that Olmsted had is that it's not an island. It's not purely an island or an oasis. It's actually a part of an urban environment, and it's also something that we now understand to be part of a global environment. And it registers changes in the global environment. It registers, it's an index of climate change, right? And it's also something we understand as being precious and delicate and of representing biodiversity and of having an important role to play in kind of connecting young people to the living world. And so it has many ways in which Olmsted couldn't have anticipated. It has many ways in which it reaches out to the public. So a major question, I think, is how we can bring that out and bring that out in powerful ways. I mean, what kinds of technologies, what kinds of virtual maps of the place, what kinds of field notebooks could help to register the fact that this arboretum is situated within a whole world environment. So, David Attenborough, I want to switch to talking about the kind of broader context that I think we're dealing with and that I would be excited to hear the room's thoughts on, which is how do we relate to nature through media? And how have we done that historically, and how is network technology changing possibilities for doing so? So with delightful David Attenborough, we have someone who goes out into the world and explores. We have him pulling out charismatic organisms and sharing them. And yet now, with the coming of network technologies and YouTube, there are different ways of sharing. I have no idea how to theorize what that means. but I'm certain that there's something that matters about the fact that, you know, children and the way they relate to nature aren't, as sort of someone like Richard Louv writing about Last Child in the Woods would talk about, aren't going out in the world in the forest and kind of getting their hands dirty and then, you know, coming home and talking effusively about what they've seen. In many ways, they're experiencing a nature that is coming to them through screens. And there's been debates about whether this is just such a bad thing and we need to just make sure and compensate for it by having children get out in nature more and have their restorative experiences, or if about a more complicated and nuanced view in which something like this can actually make a difference. As sort of ridiculous as it seems, like the author Carol Jung had written about how this might be a kind of unexpected bridge for someone to care about a certain creature like a lemur or sloth. Lemur. No, it's a lemur.
It's a lemur.
It's a lemur. It says right there. It's a dramatic lemur. So, And so one project that we're doing that I think kind of interestingly addresses this question is with Nuvu Studio. Nuvu Studio is a group in Cambridge that invites mostly teenagers to do projects where making is a form of learning, and they've done things like reinvent breakfast. What else have they done? They've created a chair that moves away from under you when you try to sit down.
Right. They've played with lively furniture as a kind of technological intervention. With flying, students have created sort of 3D virtual flying simulators with hammocks and projection. They do a lot of really creative work with technology and making and education.
So what we thought to do is invite those students in that class to build a kind of rover that would be they wouldn't have to land it themselves, but which would arrive in the Arboretum in the middle of winter and through which they could have a kind of exploration of the landscape. And they could take data about what they find there. And then they would have to narrate that what they've discovered in the same way as a kind of Mars rover and the Mars Curiosity rover. They'd have to make this knowledge available. It might seem, oh, that's just adding to a kind of mediation, and that's just making it so that those students aren't relating to the natural world in the way we want to. It's not authentic. But in fact, it may be just proliferating the forms through which the natural world can come to our attention and through which we might be primed to care about it. And it might make manifest things that otherwise don't get seen, and particularly plants and trees, which lack the kind of movement and charisma, or at least apparently do, that something like a lemur with massive eyes has. I'll quickly move out of this. So we are... So I think one has to be really creative with the way one works with organisms and landscapes that otherwise don't obviously compel our looking. And I think this is a great example of that. Okay. So, as a kind of the cascading towards the end of my talk, and I realize I should wrap up fairly soon, I'd like to talk through two key kind of concepts that I think are important. First, I should mention that I think one of the ways that it'll be really fascinating for us to do something like this is something that we call a kind of deep timeline, which is to take a plant in an Arboretum landscape and just throw a ton of sensors on it so that it just spits out data about how it's changing and about how its microclimates are changing, and to make this visible for even a whole year, and through that to kind of show how this plant is changing and how it's on a journey, it's kind of moving through time, and then to do that in a way that is familiar in the sense of the kind of emerging profile of that plant, so that it becomes not necessarily humanized, but it becomes alive to us. And the kind of cascade towards the end of the talk, I want to talk about two things, which is the virtual and the notion of the Umwelt. There's been this notion from John Dixon Hunt, who's a historian of landscape architecture and of gardens, that a garden has always possessed the potential to offer its visitors the same sort of experience as is nowadays available in forms we call virtual reality. And I take that to mean that alongside the kind of bare material reality of the soil and vegetation and paths and roads, gardens solicit their visitors and transport them and make it possible to tell stories about natural history or about culture, and especially so if one moves through the garden with imagination. And then what you see on the left is the way that information, at least in these early iterations of people imagining virtual reality, is imagined as a kind of garden, or it's spatialized in a way. And so I'm fascinated at the way in which the kind of virtual garden or the kind of virtual movement through information might coalesce with a kind of moving through the virtual reality of a physical garden. And in that sense, I'm wondering about what it would be like to have a very immersive sonic experience if one was to move towards plants and they were announcing information about themselves, or if one moved up to it and could have that kind of data about the microclimate that one found there, and if how that would kind of make one realize that these things were moving and changing. And as a final concept, I wanted to talk about the Umwelt, because I think it's extraordinarily important part of what I've been talking about this whole time, which is about people's perception changing and about people being able to reach out and see plants and other creatures from their perspectives. And so there's this delightful book called A Stroll Through the Worlds of Animals and Men by Jacob von, I believe it's pronounced Exkull, but I'm not sure. Exkull. Thank you. In which he's describing what is an Umwelt versus an environment. So we all have an environment around us which is made up of certain physical features, but what is our perceptual environment? What are the things that we notice and care about and compel our action? And so he talks about a tick's Umwelt, and this is what he says. The whole rich world around the tick shrinks and changes into a scanty frame. Oh, this is when the tick lands on some skin. The whole rich world around the tick shrinks and changes into a scanty framework consisting in essence of three receptor cues and three effector cues, her Umwelt. The tick, falling on the hairs of the mammal, projects the effector cue of shock onto them. This, in turn, releases a tactile cue, which extinguishes the olfactory stimulus of the butyric acid. The new receptor cue elicits running about until it, in turn, is replaced by the sensation of heat, which starts the boring response. And what I find really inspiring about Uxkull's vision is that he's able to show us different ways of seeing the same landscape through different eyes. And in this case, you have a village street seen through a photograph, seen through a screen, seen by a fly, and then delightfully seen by a mollusk. I don't know what the Arboretum would look like through the eyes of a mollusk, but it would be a beautiful thing to render. And then he has this delightful conclusion where he takes an oak tree and he imagines the different Umwelten that you find in that tree, the different ways the different creatures carve out that space. So a fox finds that it affords shelter, or an ant is moving along its bark, or a forester finds that it is measuring it because he's simply interested in it as a potential source of bark. Or a little girl is frightened by it because she sees a face in it. And what Exkul writes about it is delightful, and I think gets at the kind of way in which we want the multiplicities of the Arboretum to come out through network technologies. He says, corresponding to the different functional tones, the perceptual images of the oak tree's numerous inmates, too, are differently shaped. Each umwelt carves a specific section out of the oak, whose qualities are suitable bearers for both the receptor and effector cues of their respective functional cycles. In the ant's world, all the rest of the oak vanishes behind its gnarled bark, whose furrows and heights become the ants. In all the 100 different umwelten of its inmates, the oak tree as an object plays a highly varied role, at one time with some of its parts, at other times with others. Should we attempt to epitomize all the contradictory properties with the oak tree as an object, which the oak tree as an object displays, only chaos would result. And yet they are all but parts of a subject firmly structured in itself, which bears and harbors all these umwelten, not comprehended and never discernible to all the builders of these umwelten. So I think what we're talking about is amplifying our attention to our own and others' umwelten. And, you know, we're asking how technology can play a role in the way that we carve out sections of trees and landscapes. And we're also asking what happens to our umwelt when we're confronted with network technologies, but also with the massive environmental change. As Bruno Latour asks, he says, is there a way to bridge the distance between the scale of the phenomena we hear about, when he's talking about ecological catastrophe, and the tiny umwelt inside which we witness as if we were all fish inside a bowl, an ocean of catastrophes that are supposed to unfold. So I'm wondering, can experiences that integrate physical and virtual encounter via new technologies kind of bridge this distance and make it possible for us to cognize, appreciate, and make sensory these massive changes that are going on? So I'm aware that we're running out of time, and I want to leave some time for a Q&A.
I hope you'll share the recording now.
So I was going to quickly go through some examples of projects that use trees, like this one. I'll share the recording.
Yeah.
Like this one of Projections on Trees by Craig Walsh. It's done in Hyde Park in Sydney, where people are giving testimonies about that place as a site of protest. Or of this project, where the rings of a tree become an opportunity to create music based on different qualities, you know, their strength and their width and so on. Citizen science projects where mobile technologies invite children to gather data about their world and to observe, and I think do this in this wonderful way, augment the world around them, but do so through expanding their umwelten. Tree listening, where one hears the movements of nutrients through the tree and also can hear the shifting of the tree in the wind. And I think one of Matthew's favorites, the kind of registering of tree shadows on photosensitive blueprint paper. And this project, where 100 clones were taken and planted in different sites around the Bay Area, and it was shown that they all grew radically differently. So they became a kind of index of their environments. And so I thought I would finish, before turning it over to the rest of the room, by sharing a recording that we took with a young child named Max, who was exploring the Arboretum, doing that kind of exercise that Matthew and I had imagined. And it's a kind of notion of the journaling that we were talking about, where the Arboretum landscape seems to afford not just understanding of plants and learning about plants, not just restorative experiences, but can be kind of worked with to create new imaginations. Hopefully, Max, you can hear him.
We were like escorts, basically, of these brownies at a training commerce that was going on at the bridge.
Well, let me preface it more, I think, so you'll understand it. They had basically followed mushrooms around the Arboretum and turned it into a big virtual reality game, where they were protecting the so-called brownies who lived in the mushrooms from being destroyed because they no longer had resources.
We were like escorts, basically, of these brownies at a training commerce that was going on at the bridge. It was the new bridge, right? And so And they were either training or discussing something. We couldn't
They went to the Moon Bridge to talk about moving because they live in mushrooms. And the mushrooms were dying where they live. And so the three brownies wanted to go to Massino, but the other brownies wanted to stay where they were. And they decided to try to destroy them so that they didn't, like, tell everyone that they needed to move.
So then we had to run away with them. And one got killed about escaping, one of the brownies. So we had to put a mushroom grave over it. Then we wandered around. We actually crossed the street and did a banana turn and came back here because that's... and so then we wandered around and found many good mushrooms that the brownies could use.
I think that says more than I can in any conceptual way, the potential that there lies in taking a technology and having it become a bridge to all sorts of experiences that that we can't quite imagine yet. So with that, I thought I would turn it over to the room and hear questions or thoughts on the kinds of propositions that I've shared today, and particularly, like, what are we missing, or what should be added, or which of these are the most exciting, or what would you want to encounter, what kind of tool would you want to have in the Arboretum?
So I'm interested in how you've talked to people who use the Arboretum. So you've offered a very thoughtful picture of the different possible ways people could use the Arboretum, and some obviously coming from observations of people who are sort of using it as a green space or an entertainment space or so on and so forth. And you're seeing this sort of potential to put all these different layers on top of the experience, but there is this sort of open question of what do the people who are using the Arboretum want from the Arboretum? Is that any part of your work, that sort of question of talking to the people that you're hoping to reach with these projects?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, and I think that's the stage that we really need to get into next. And the exploration we did that you just heard the recording from is, I think, the beginning of that, but there's much more that could be done. We have talked a little bit, and there's definitely excitement about particularly the journaling aspect. But I think finding ways to do experiments that could then generate feedback would be very powerful.
So I don't know if the recording was Dutch, so I missed it. It was done at Arboretum or at the Switched On Data Garden in Philadelphia. I don't know if you know about it. The ones that they do at the end of the design conference. You might want to take a look at that because it looked like it came from.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that recording that you just heard was done in the Arboretum.
No, not that one. One where people are listening with a headset to the movement of the juices in a tree.
Oh, yeah, that was at Kew Gardens, I believe. Botanical Garden in London.
Yeah, the one I'm talking about is the one that is usually done every year. It's the oldest botanical surviving garden in the United States in Philadelphia.
Yeah, I think that project has been in residence in several places, actually.
What I find interesting is there's, you're almost talking about two different things. The information that maybe with the missions, or the various missions of the Arboretum, that you want the public or the users of the Arboretum to understand, to make it richer in experience. And then the looking at it from the other perspective, the, oh my God, let's look at the kitty looking at the lemur. Let's draw people into this. And then use that as a catalyst for their own perceptual experiences. And they're two very, very diverse, they kind of got melded together. But I think at some level, as something that I think would be really lovely is with every new bit of information, and I think as somebody, I've lived here and experienced the Arboretum all my life. So I went to see the lilacs with my grandmother. I lived two blocks away from the Arboretum. And so there's a way of experiencing something in a superficial way, which is that secondary, like, oh, let's look at it. But then how do you dig into something and then take away from it the, you know, the information? And so, you know, when I look at your project, or as I listen to your project, it's like the pieces of information that are portals to deeper knowledge, whether it's going to be about global warming or whether it's about this amazing history from, you know, the Victorian mindset of plant hunting,
right,
and how it's morphed into ideas about environmental art, the future of our planet and our environment. And so, you know, perhaps what I'm really trying to say is, you know, looking for nodes or portals, mm-hmm. that are that enable the perceiver to create greater knowledge and to share that. And so that's in some ways, perhaps, you know, if I were to look at ways of making the project really juicy,
yeah,
what I would go for, particularly from an education point of view, particularly from children, because you see children just looking at something and then you can say, oh, that's a flower. But then you understand, oh, that's a flower and these are the parts and how they work. Or this flower came from China and was collected by this particular scientist.
Right, right. Yeah, some of this gets to the point that Ethan was asking about as well with respect to, you know, letting, finding ways to let users, visitors to the Arboretum help direct the ways in which, you know, we make data accessible for them. I mean, that mushroom story that child told can become a place that acts in all kinds of ways for drawing out ecological relationships. Those mushrooms grow in association with certain trees, and the fact that they're growing in one place and not in other places tells you something about what trees and what mushrooms like to live together. We found that in the course of that project, where we brought a bunch of children and their parents of a mixed variety of ages into the Arboretum and basically asked them to come up with stories about their experience, the children were coming up with kind of interaction models that we hadn't anticipated. One cohort of kids, slightly older than the ones telling the mushroom story, suggested that it would be useful to have an app that would allow you to design a game of capture the flag in the Arboretum, that would tell you, for instance, where particular trees are that make good hiding places, that are room-like or maze-like. And that was a marvelous notion. And you can also see, again, nodes there where that you know, that child's umwelt could be exposed to some kind of expansion by thinking about what kinds of trees make better rooms or better mazes than others, why a particular tree has been pruned in a particular way that lends itself to being a base or a goal or a place to put a flag or a place to hide behind. So I think there's a lot more kind of work for us to do in terms of teasing out some kind of grounded theory of, you know, what it is that people experience when they're in the Arboretum, and ways to use those as kind of interfaces to these disparate sets of data, these really remarkably disparate and diverse sets of data that range from field notebooks and herbarium specimens to the distribution of plants in the landscape and the interaction of those landscapes with time, how those plants respond to climatic change, to changes in the built environment around the Arboretum. But definitely, I think, finding ways to make those interactions the starting point for deeper dives into the data is really the challenge and the opportunity.
I wonder if we thought about who the ideal user is, because you talk about the experience of being in the Arboretum and you invoke Olmsted as someone who had very specific values on a space and very specific concepts of beauty and was interacting with an emerging urbanism and was counteracting that. And as you propose these interventions, there are specific values in those propositions that you are trying to create a particular user that is perhaps in tune with certain notions of the sublime. I assume that it's moving beyond the 19th century notion of the sublime to the space of that space, or the space of nature. And so I guess that's my first question. So not only have you talked to users, but what are your particular values and the kind of user you're trying to create is one of the questions. A couple others. A related question is what are the values of technology that you're bringing to this? And you made some comments about how technology has the potential of creating deeper connections, but I'm wondering, what are the qualities of technology that are doing that, and how do those particular qualities provide the interventions that you're looking for? So I'm thinking specifically about the communing with nature being traditionally a very individualistic process, and really what some of the qualities of the technology might suggest a kind of social or network piece of this. And so you're moving away from these sort of 19th century models of nature and its place within an urban environment to something that is social, collaborative in nature. So maybe you could just talk a little bit about values, both of user and technology.
You want to jump in, Kyle?
Sure. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, a few thoughts about that. First of all, and Ned may want to jump in as well, about users, because beyond these kind of expressive engagements that we're thinking about, or learning engagements, you know, there are other user cohorts of the Arboretum as well, in particular researchers, and thinking about ways to make data that are right now in many different formats, not all of them digitized, kind of accessible to analysis for researchers is another piece of our engagement with the Arboretum that we didn't really touch on here. And so thinking about, just in technical terms, about backends to a system that could push data out programmatically to different kinds of encounters is a kind of part of the technical side of the project that we have yet to address. In terms of thinking about the values of the technology, I think that it's an important focus for us to have and to foreground throughout, to question at every point what the assumptions that come with our particular interest in any given technology, any given media interaction with the space, what kind of epistemic virtues might be expressed or hidden within those engagements. And I think you're absolutely right to identify a distinction between a kind of, you know, romantic reverie and a kind of experience of a highly individual experience of nature as sublime, the enormity of nature, the grandeur of nature, and to contrast that with ways in which technology enables a kind of shared engagement. I mean, it's very possible for technology to also build walls around experiences and to kind of force us to double down on that highly individuated experience. So in terms of thinking about what values inhere in technologies that we want to promote, I think exploring those social, shareable, networkable experiences is something that we want to see the technology do, and make those values in the technology dialogue with those long-standing values born of romantic engagement, born of kind of scientific engagement with an environment and a demand for empirical justification for conclusions one might draw. Hopefully, to bring technology to bear on letting these different worldviews of nature and experiences of nature dialogue with each other.
It's worth, I just want to reflect a little bit on when we talk about technology. I mean, I don't know that I can distinguish between a small iPad, all the computers here, and a piece of paper. Everything is about an institution that provides information through some mechanism. And there are assumptions and there are limitations and there are constraints in everything. So the fact that we have copper tags that are essentially inscrutable to 99% of the people who come communicates something. I can't know. Or that we have to go to a visitor center that's remote from most of our collections to get a piece of paper that tells the single story that a person who works at the Arboretum can tell about a tree. There's just nothing that's already sort of value-free or in essence...
Technology's already interposing itself.
We have we have these limitations. So what we're really after are ways of taking what I think of as 15,000 portals that are rooted in deep time, basically 3.5 billion years of life, that are rooted in our future, that play out over the course of the environmental change that's human-mediated. And we need to make sure that when people interact, we want to get away from the show garden, the entertainment garden. I'm not interested in, can we get more people? I'm interested in a deeper level of experience. And it really isn't, there's, I would say what we're really after is doing sufficient numbers of experiments that we will find out some of these things will work well. Some of them will be miserable failures, but it's actually pretty hard to predict. And I think one of the things I worry about is when I hear, who are we after? What do we got to figure out what they want. And the world's so inherently complex, and the organisms we care for are so inherently complex, that the minute I interpose myself into that equation, I've already shut down 99.999% of what could happen. So a lot of what's made this very appealing is we're not really sure what's going to happen. And I'll give you a sort of an antidote to technology. After I got to the Arboretum just under 2 years ago, I wanted to free people from, in the summer we had programs in a building. But unlike most museums, none of our collections are in the building, right? So you go to the HMNH and you see skeletons and you have to really go inside the building. But frankly, there isn't a single thing worth seeing for a visitor, in essence, that isn't outside. So we sort of ended up, a scientist and I ended up thinking about flash mobs, spontaneity. We created this concept called tree mobs. And there is no technology except the ability to blast out information about the coordinates of where to meet on a Thursday at 6 in our arboretum. And one of us will show up and talk about that tree, or how you built ships in the 18th century with these kinds of woods. And again, it's endless. And ultimately, all the technology has done is put a human being next to the actual organism to reflect on it in a way that no one could ever put on a sheet of paper. So the technology, I think we all agree, has to be thought through, because again, you don't do anything without thinking it through. But most of what we're after is sheer experimentation of how to move people out of this almost trans-like experience of walking through, you know, it's beautiful because they're cherry blossoms. So you see them, you've experienced them, and then you're gone. So field notebooks, you come home. We can sweep your data. We have an IT staff, we have GIS systems, everything's mapped, all 15,000 organisms within a decimeter of their place on the planet Earth. You walk through our environment, we can record every walk if you wish. You can record your feelings about every walk. And you can actually, as a school child, 40 years from now, know what it was you felt in some sort of wonderful memory. But you'll know all of these things. So we don't know. And I think this is where, but I think the one thing I think we have to all admit is nothing is value-free. You give people a piece of paper, you've already cut off a number of things. You give them a phone, and other people say, I don't want this. I don't want any technology between me and these organisms. So this just becomes part of a spectrum of interactions.
Yeah, that's great.
I just wanted to say, well, initially I wanted to say that I would echo the comments that have been made about the user, and that when I was listening to Kyle, I was wondering, you know, who is the user and what do you want the user to do and how you want to draw the user out. Now, your comments kind of squish that and say, well, you know, that's not really the key point. So my comment is kind of obviated, I guess, but I did want to add just one thing. When you were talking about social media, for example, you know, the YouTube cat, and even the David Attenborough approach to, you know, presentation of information and making people care, or making the user care, it came to me that those are global things. David Attenborough talks on a global scale. And the Arnold Arboretum is a very local place, and it's also a very urban place. You know, we were talking about Olmsted, and actually you mentioned how Olmsted had a problem between the park and the Arboretum. It's a kind of a conflict. So I guess my concern would be, or what I would want to know more about, is how does whatever technology you introduce square that gap between the global and the local? And I think this woman before me, when she was talking about those nodes, was maybe addressing some of that as well. I mean, if there's anyway, but your yeah. comments about the users kind of...
Well, no, I mean, it's just a perspective, yeah. but I mean, our users are the entire population of Boston, which, I mean, how can I categorize it?
Yeah.
And it's the rest of the world that comes to us. And what I found is, you know, you may find certain profiles more often than others, but it's really diverse. And walking around, you say you lived near it, it's one of the places in Boston which is truly diverse on a weekend day with the sun out. And so, you know, you almost have to be so careful not to over-prescribe, you know, who you think. Mm-hmm. But so yeah, but I just want to return the volley on global. We are actually both, in an interesting way, a global and a local institution. So we are a local park. People can walk into us. But the fact of the matter is, when it comes to climate change, we're a major point in a global network of gardens right now that are collecting data on phenology, the timing of bud break, of flower, that are tracking the very real things in real time. We actually have sensors out in the environment. So we actually are speaking to extinction. We're speaking to germplasm preservation because our collection holdings are the strongest in the world from temperate Asia. And we were collecting over a century ago, so there are places that are no longer there. So this is the interesting mix. And part of what I would say we haven't done is we haven't shaped enough of the image of ourselves as this both local and global. And so this comes back to how do we sort of open the spigot to create these experiences that reflect on these two faces of the Arboretum.
Yeah, I think that...
One thing that I often come back to in my mind is if I were to learn about climate change from a scientist, say through a recording, standing in front of a plant that really indexed climate change versus reading about it in a book or watching David Attenborough talk about it, I think there's something epiphanal in that. There's something powerful in that. And it gets at the sort of local global where I, in my own little umwelt, have a kind of, I'm challenged to understand how my pushing of the accelerator is having these global effects. And yet if I'm kind of able to hear that story told in the presence of a plant that is living and shifting as a result of these changes, then kind of this leap takes place between the local and the global. And then there's a kind of...
Maybe you can have an app. How quickly can you kill this tree?
Wow.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And again, we can model out exactly what won't be in our collection as easily as we can model in what couldn't be in our collection and what will be in our collection.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that the diversity of the Arboretum in time, as well as its geographical, the broad geographical suite from which its specimens are drawn, is one of the really rich potential sources of information and enlightenment that the collection has to offer. And enlarging that umwelt in time as well as in space or community is a crucial affordance that trees have to offer that a lot of these other charismatic creatures of nature and Marlon Perkins' Wild Kingdom, which was like mother's milk to me when I was growing up. I mean, that stuff is extraordinarily important, but that's nature happening in another place all too often. And to bring that global and long durée, deep time perspective into a local place is really, I think, a crucial affordance of the Arboretum. We have time for one more question. You have one down there.
Yeah, I think it sounded to me like the mission was pleasingly vague, so that you can choose whether you want to pay attention to the users or not. It doesn't oblige you in any way to do that. So you know, in terms of that discussion, you can basically decide what you want to do. And because you were saying, what are we missing? I'm an historian of science by training, and so I've been trying to think about that. I mean, gardens started off as very moral statements, you know, about the sublime, and so it's the Garden of Eden, which is a place of order that doesn't stink, where there is no sin, and it sounds to me like a lot of the suggestions here are similar. You know, you want to make a moral statement somehow, which you can choose, right? Because your mission tells you or lets you do whatever you want. And so the moral statement could be something about the the breakdown of the earth as we know it, or the sublime still, the encounter with God, the encounter with something that is so amazing that you don't think about normally. And I mean, Capability Brown and Olmsted and people like that, that's the kind of stuff that they cared about, really, right? That, and so you might want to go back into the history of gardens and see what did, if you want to. It's up to you, right? You might go back and say, what were they trying to do? And now that we live in a world where the outside of the garden is different, what would that be now? Because that's the interesting part, it seems to me, of what you're talking about. We experience the garden in a different way because when we walk in the street, it doesn't stink as bad as it did, you know, way back then. Right? It's not a contrast in the same way. So what is the experience of the sublime in a garden in the 21st century? Yeah, exactly. I mean, exactly. That's what, at least in our generation, right? But I doubt that a 13-year-old would experience it that way.
I just want to say that one of the things that we're thinking about, I mean, we are definitely interested in the history of gardens and the ways in which these different gardens at different times and the collections of living things that have been contained within them have been thought of as telling different kinds of stories, as expressing different kinds of virtues. To a certain extent, you know, the kind of potential of network culture to allow us to kind of put these times into dialogue with one another is one of the interesting aspects of this project. To look at, to look at and understand the kind of history of the epistemological encounter with plants in different times and places. And understand how the Arboretum already is a kind of tapestry of kind of clashing perspectives that, as Olmsted identified, it was difficult for him to imagine bringing a botanical garden and a landscape, a park, into one and the same place. And so there was already a mediation taking place. And to continue that dialogue, to enhance that dialogue, to understand our own buried assumptions and the virtues and the goods that we want to promote in our own time as being part of a dialogue with that kind of longer history is certainly a kind of cultural and intellectual goal of the project, to be sure. We do have to wrap up, but thank you all for your ideas and questions and contributions.